home and my mother was here, she would look at all of you and say, what are you doing inside on a beautiful day like that? And in part, it's because we don't get this kind of weather very often, but I realize it's kind of every day for you guys. And it's, but we do appreciate you taking the time out and being here. We're delighted and privileged to be part of the teaching team here at Holden this week. And we're actually bringing a bit of work that we're doing back home and trying to translate it into North America. This mightn't work. And so there's a nice bit of risk about it. But actually, the Bible is such an extraordinary book for all times and all contexts and all people when we read it well. And I hope that as we read this extraordinary little book, we'll see it speak and hear it speak into the contemporary world of North America today. I'm very conscious that it's coming out of a place back home. These conversations are coming out of a very conflicted spot back home. We have in 2012 back in Ireland, we embarked on a decade long season of centenaries, beginning in 2012 with the centenary of the signing of the Ulster Covenant, which was a big protest movement amongst Protestants in Northern Ireland and a very conflicted date. 1913 was a big workers' strike in Dublin, the Great Lockout, we call it, in 1913. 1914, the beginning of the war. 1914, the beginning of the First World War. 1916, a really seminal date in the history of Ireland. In the Protestant community, it's celebrated as marked as the year, the centenary of the Battle of the Somme, in which so many young men from Northern Ireland sacrificed themselves on the battlefields of France and Belgium. What's hardly known also is that so many young men from the south of Ireland did the same, fighting in the British Army in that First World War. So 1916 is a really important date in the Protestant community, but also in the Catholic nationalist Irish community, because it marks the centenary of the Easter Rising. Or if you are a little bit on the other side of that whole thing, we talk about the rebellion, the Irish Rebellion in 1916. So part also, the naming is part of our conflict. This year in November, marking the centenary of the ending of the First World War, and then we enter into a series of dates which are really, really important in Irish history. We enter into a period of 3 years or so where we're marking our own Declaration of Independence. We're marking a tragic civil war, and we're also marking the formation of Northern Ireland, the arbitrary drawing of a border in the northeast corner, which divided the island, and which is a source of so much conflict still right up to today. All of those dates, all of those anniversaries are points of tension on a conflicted island. When you layer across the top of all that the Brexit vote, where we're arguing about borders again, and we're arguing about relationships between North and South, between East and West, between the island of Ireland and the island of Great Britain, and then also the relationships with Europe, you can see that we're into how it raises the tensions on the island and raises tensions in ways that we thought we had laid to rest, or at least we had put away for a period of time. So our islands are tense and difficult places. What we found was that This is the context within which the background to all conversations back home. And yet, we found that our faith communities were not talking about these issues. They're too difficult, too complex. Our congregations are too divided. We don't know how people voted on the Brexit referendum. We don't want to raise the potential of difficult conversations in our congregations. And so for the vast majority of our churches on the island, nobody's talking about this because it's too difficult. So both Padraig and I work with an organization called Coromila, community called Coromila, which is the oldest peace and reconciliation community on the island. And we are committed to enabling and facilitating and creating space for difficult conversations. So this was our territory. How do we step into these tense areas and enable people of faith to have difficult conversations? Because we believe that conflict is transformed through human encounter. And so for the last number of months, we've been traveling around our islands with groups as large as two or three to one or 200 maybe, having these conversations. And we have been astounded again about how this simple little book of Ruth speaks into a context like Brexit and everything that swirls around Brexit. And it enables faith communities to step in to that difficult ground because we are doing it with our tradition in hand. And we find our tradition is living and active and enables us to claim some of that space for complex conversations. That's the background to it. Now, I realize there's not a whole lot of conflict and difficulty over here, but I hope that you will permit me the opportunity to, you can imagine that your society is conflicted and imagine what it would be like, and we'll see how the conversation goes. Be very conscious as we have come here to Holden, as we have retreated from the world, we have also, it seems, walked into the embrace of what is best in ourselves. And we have been struck by how warm you are to one another and to us as strangers in your midst. How hospitable this place has been. And it gives us an opportunity in a living an experimental way to imagine and experience a little bit of what it could be like. And so we hope that that some of this conversation will enable us not just to reimagine what our community, what our society could be, but also to begin to see what the steps are as we walk towards it. As Sharon said, Padraig we'll be taking some of the text of Ruth in a different session and enabling you to reflect on it, to write about it, to write poetry and prayers in relation to the text, because these are other ways in which we read it, this text, and how this text reads us. So all that is by way of introduction. And over these three sessions, we'll cover most of the territory of the story of Ruth. Now, there are lots of different ways of reading the text. One of the ways of reading it is we recreate the text from our memory of that text. So today, we're just going to spend some time in a few verses in chapter 1. But I'd be really interested to know what we know about the book of Ruth. Now, if you've preached sermon series on it, we don't need a sermon series on it. We just need the headlines of the story. What can we remember together about the first chapter of Ruth? How it opens, what the context is, who the characters are, what happens? And if you've got a smartphone and you've got a Bible text, don't cheat. No cheating. I saw you. So, what can you remember about the book of Ruth?
It starts with Naomi.
Does it?
That's what I remember.
Mm-hmm. Starts with Naomi. Anybody else? Who is Naomi? What do we know about Naomi from those early verses?
Well, Elimelech had two sons.
She had two sons, yes. And I heard a name. Her husband, and I heard his name, his Elimelech. Yes. Okay. So we've got a family here, a woman and a man and their two sons. Anybody remember the names of the two sons?
Malon.
Good. And?
Chilion.
Good. Yeah. Okay. Elimelech dies. Where does he die? Moab. Do you know where they were from originally?
Yeah.
Bethlehem.
They were in Bethlehem, but they died in Moab. Why did they have to go to Moab? There was famine in the land, and they had to go to Moab, where Elimelech dies. Anything else? This is great, because this is like the first three verses.
Both of the sons found wives in Moab.
Yes, they did. And their names were?
Orpah and Ruth.
Good.
Foreigners.
Oh, yes. We're going to spend plenty of time thinking about that. They married outside the tribe. Although, who were the foreigners?
Actually,
They were. Okay. So they find wives. They find Moabite wives. And then the two guys die. So we're in like five verses and we have walked into a world of famine and death and widowhood and mourning in just five verses. It's an extraordinary opening to the text. Okay, now before we jump into that, we've reconstructed it well. We look at the text carefully in a moment. We're interested in borders and crossing borders. We've already raised an issue about who the foreigners are in the story. Because we're slightly on the back foot in relation to that. But we're interested in neighbours and the borders between neighbours. Just for a moment or two, I want you to maybe turn to the person beside you or if you're from the same place, maybe find somebody from a different place. Says he, talking to a room full of Iowans and Minnesotans, no doubt. But two tasks. Have a conversation. What stories do neighboring states tell about your state? And what stories does your state tell about your neighbors? Okay? And I'll give you 2 or 3 minutes to have a think about that and act like you understand the instructions and we go. I'm like teacher at the front of the class. Everybody back home, we do this. That's it. Cuneus, be cune. Be quiet. Good, everybody. Okay, let me hear some stories about. Be mindful of the company you're in as well as you tell these stories. What stories do you tell? What stories do you hear about your state? What stories does your state tell about your neighbors? Anybody want to volunteer? Yeah, Ginger.
I'm from Washington, but Idaho is full of white supremacist Nazis. And Mormons.
Right. Okay. Let's jump right in there. Great.
We're from the Chicago area. Okay. Used to be more than now. Think about Al Capone. You know,
yes, yes.
You travel somewhere and you say you're from Chicago.
Gangster.
Yeah.
You're all gangsters. Yeah. Any other?
Our conversation immediately went into what the state's political leanings are.
Yeah. Right.
And she comes from a divided state. I come from there's no question about what our state says.
Okay. And we know that for sure. We know that this is because we're going to pick up an issue that this kind of issue in a moment. Any other stories that we tell or we hear? Yeah.
Wait. Iowa and our neighbors here from Minnesota. The people from Iowa go to Minnesota to fish, and then we find out what the people in Minnesota think about Iowa fishermen. So,
should not be doing that again.
I'm not one of them.
I'm from Minnesota. I talked to someone from South Dakota, and South Dakota would see Minnesota as too liberal. And South Dakota would see Minnesota as stealing their preachers and teachers because we pay more in Minnesota for preachers and teachers, apparently. So South Dakota is losing some of their talent.
Good. This is, I've no doubt that we could spend a very amusing and maybe sad as well morning talking about our neighboring states. Notionally, and I know something about the independence of the states and so on, but notionally you're all part of the one, you know, country, and yet you have stories about those who live closest to you. You cross a notional state line and all those people are Republican, or all those people are Democrat, or all those, and yet we speak the same language, we watch the same TV shows, more or less. Maybe the news might be different, but sports, the whole works. How interesting the diversity is, and how we tell stories about those who are slightly different. There's those opening five verses of the book of Ruth, which we reconstructed together. There's not a great deal more information than what we talked about, but a couple of things to point out perhaps in this text. Well, let me read it first, actually. In the days when the judges ruled, there was a famine in the land. So a man from Bethlehem in Judah, together with his wife and two sons, went to live for a while in the country of Moab. The man's name was Elimelech, and his wife's name was Naomi, and the names of his two sons were Mahlon and Chilion. They were Ephrathites from Bethlehem, Judah, and they went to Moab and lived there. Now Elimelech, Naomi's husband, died, and she was left with her two sons. They married Moabite women, one named Orpah and the other named Ruth. After they'd lived there about 10 years, both Mahlon and Chilion also died, and Naomi was left without her two sons and her husband. A couple of things. There's so much in these few verses, but just for the sake of our conversation this morning. In Hebrew, the name Bethlehem, Bethlehem, is house of bread. And the story starts us off in an unusual situation in that there is famine in the house of bread. This isn't supposed to happen. This is an unusual set of circumstances. And this guy, Elimelech, with his wife and his two sons, move. Because of famine, they are forced to cross a national border. Now, Elimelech, his name in Hebrew, there's a couple of different possibilities for what his name means. One could be that God is my king. Or another possible translation for it is that I may be king. And within Jewish tradition, Elimelech is generally believed to be a man of some standing in the country. And he must obviously have had some degree of resource, some degree of wealth, because he was able to finance his way across a border in famine. And so within Jewish tradition, he's not treated very kindly. In fact, he's known as stingy Elimelech, because he should have used his resource to help his neighbors. Instead, he financed an escape for his family across the border into Moab. That's the second thing I want us just to spend a moment or two thinking about: Moab. Moab and Israel are neighboring states. They're right alongside one another. They're not big. They're nowhere near the size of a state here. But if you imagine that is the Mediterranean coast, this is Judah. The River Jordan's running down here. This is Moab. So they're right up close together. They don't quite speak the same language, but they can make themselves understood. They share some cultural affinity, but they are different states. And he's able to flee across into Moab. Now, the beauty of the story and the genius of the storyteller is this. Look how concerned he is that in just a few verses, he's kind of ramming it home to us where they went. It's far more important than where they came from, where they went to. Three times he mentions their destination. And that's because the writer can rely on his hearers or his readers filling in the detail about what we know about Moab. Let me fill you in on some of the detail. Just as you have stories about your neighboring states and they have about you, so do Israel and Moab. Judah and Moab have stories about one another. These are stories that go like way back. One thing they know is you can't trust them. You can't trust a Moabite, particularly in a time of crisis. And we know that because right back in the book of Deuteronomy, in the book of Numbers, the Judahites remember after they came out of Egypt and they were wandering through the desert and making their way to their promised land, they reach a place in which there is a particular hunger and a particular lack. And they send to the king of Moab for food and for water. Not only after he turns to his advisors and he listens to what the advisors say, not only does the king refuse to provide food and water for a needy people, he actually ends up hiring a man to follow along behind these hungry, thirsty people, hurling curses at them. You know the story about the man with the talking donkey? And you're thinking, what? Is that in the Bible? But the king hires a man to curse these hungry people. That settles down deep. That kind of memory settles deep and has a lasting sting. It has a particular resonance in Ireland. And I know from talking to some folks here this week, some of you, your people came here from Ireland in the middle 1800s, fleeing famine in Ireland. And the memory of the famine is still a very live one today. And it's folded into the antipathy between the two islands, between Ireland and the rest of Great Britain, particularly between Ireland and England. In our time of great hunger, when we looked to them for help, they let us down, they refused. In fact, some of those Protestant preachers even forced us to convert before they would feed us. And still today, we talk about the supers. We have a phrase about those who take the soup as people who are untrustworthy, who are turncoats, who are unstable in their allegiances. They take the soup. This is 160 years after those events when you think relationships have been transformed and yet it's still deep. They can't be trusted. Moab can't be trusted. The other thing we know about them is you need to watch out for their women. Because there's another story. Again, Moses is away talking with God as he does, and he comes back into the camp and there's an orgy. And the poor, innocent children, the men of the tribes of Israel, are led astray by these licentious, sexually addicted Moabite women. You can't trust Moabite women. They will lead our men astray. Now, the text relies on the fact that we pay no attention to how Moabites think about Israelite men. That's a whole other story. But here, the writer of the book of Ruth knows we can trust and rely on the fact that everybody listening to this story in Bethlehem knows exactly what Moabite women are like. You can't trust them. And the third thing, their morals are, I've said questionable, but it's worse than that. They have no morals. And we know that because of, again, this is all in our biblical text. We know that about the Moabites, and they know it about the Moabites because they remember their origins. They know where they're from. Don't know if you remember the story, but at the fall of Sodom and Gomorrah, Lot flees with both of his daughters. His wife is consumed in the flight, and he survives with both his daughters. And they find themselves in a cave overlooking the plain. And as far as they're concerned, the world has ended. This is apocalypse. They step to the mouth of the cave, and all they can see is the destruction of the two great cities of the plain. The two daughters, as far as I said they're concerned, everybody in the world is dead. And they realize, quite practically, if we don't do something about this, the human race is going to die out here. The oldest one says, here's what we're going to do. We're going to get Dad drunk tonight, and then I'm going to go in, I'll sleep with him, I'll get pregnant, and then the next night you do the same, and that way we will preserve the human race. And so the oldest daughter goes in, and it happens as she predicted both times. But the first son that is born is the primary ancestor of the Moabites. And where Israel is concerned, even the name is a slight on the moral character, because the name sounds like the Hebrew for, in Hebrew, it's Me'avi, son of my father. So the name of this people reflects Israelites' attitude to their dubious moral status and beginnings. These people, they are not to be trusted. You certainly can't trust their women. Stay away from their women, because everything about them is morally corrupt. They're our neighbors, but we kind of don't like them. And the writer of the story doesn't have to say any of this. He just drops this echo, Moab, 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 to remind you, and all sorts of things turn around in the heads of the hearers of the story right from the beginning. Let's pause there for a moment. I'm not going to explore this. I'm not going to go here. But think about, in the context of our culture and your society today, as we do for ours back home, what are the things that we can assume to know about them? That the mere mention of their name is enough to spark off a whole series of connections and memories and stereotypes of, they're all like this. Who can't you trust to watch out for their women? Who among us today do we question their moral status? This is the context for the book of Ruth. I want to make a few comments on how we stereotype one another. And again, do the work of transposition. Do the work of translation into your context. We meet with a group of people, we meet with an individual, and we pick a characteristic, particularly a characteristic that is different or foreign or one we don't like. And we take that characteristic and we make it the dominant characteristic. And then we apply it to all of those people. They're all like this because I have encountered one or I have heard of one. They're all like this. We ignore the possibility of individual difference or variation. We ignore the subtleties and complexities of human identity and the world that shapes and forms people as individuals within a community and a nation. We ignore what it is to share a common humanity. And then this characteristic that we've picked and we've blown out of all proportion and we've landed it on a whole people group, we then make it match our own fears and we make it cruel. And all of those people are like it. They can't be trusted. Their morals are questionable. They're a danger to us. In the field of conflict transformation, we talk about demonizing and characteristics of process of demonizing. We assume malign intent on their part. So characteristic statement or sentences. The harm that we have experienced, they meant it. They meant all the time to hurt us. We grow in distrust. Every idea or statement by them is wrong. And everything they propose or talk about is proposed for dishonest reasons. They can't be trusted. We externalize the guilt of that relationship. Everything bad or wrong that we have experienced is their fault. I have no culpability. It's the fault of them. They're stealing our preachers, or they're stealing our fish, or worse. We externalize guilt and we attribute evil. They want to destroy us and everything we stand for and everything we value most, and therefore they must be destroyed themselves. Zero-sum interests. Everything that benefits them harms us. If we give them an inch, they will take a mile. It was one of the characteristics of the advice given to the king of Moab about the children of Israel. He asked his advisors, should we give them food and drink? And they said, do you know those Israelites? If you give them the hint of generosity, they said, they will hoover up all the food and the water. I mean, how contemporary is that? They will hoover it all up. Everything that benefits them harms us, and vice versa. So we've externalized it. We've stereotyped this group, this whole people group. And we're in this process, and this relationship is getting more and more estranged. We are flirting with the possibility of violence against them. And then we begin to turn on our own as well. And we begin to measure disloyalty. Any criticism of us or praise of them is treasonous. Anybody who speaks well of them is disloyal to us. And it gets worse then. We prejudge the situation. Everyone in the enemy camp is an enemy. That includes our own. If you side with them, if you work for them, for their benefit, you are our enemy. You are an enemy of the state. And so into this process of demonizing, we have demonized a whole people group, but we have also begun to drive a wedge amongst ourselves. Who's with us and who's against us? Anyone, neutrality goes. It's not possible to stand in the middle anymore. It's not possible to try and hold both wings together. You're either for us or you're against us. You're either with us or you're with them. Then empathy starts to disappear. We have nothing in common with them. They are utterly alien to us. And considering them as human beings is dangerous to our project. We isolate. We cannot, therefore, dialogue or negotiate or cooperate or resolve our conflicts with them because they have malign intent towards us. The self-fulfilling prophecy of it all, their evil makes it permissible, and their danger to us makes it permissible for us to act in a hostile way towards them. Actually, it might be the patriotic thing to do, to act in a hostile way towards them, because they threaten the very foundations of what we stand for. I'm not sure if any of this translates. Now, to come back into the book of Ruth, this is all wrapped up in the word Moab. And the readers of this story, the hearers of the story, they have it all. They have a long history of engagement with this people. And that memory is generational. It has rested down deep. And it is an instinctive reaction to the name Moab. Now, here's the fantastic thing about this book. Into a very difficult place, an artist steps. And the artist writes, addresses the divisions and the conflict in his community. He addresses that conflict through a story. He addresses the conflict with a work of art. Nobody really knows how or when the book of Ruth was written. But one very plausible theory for it is that it was written after the return of from exile in Babylon. So you know the basic story. There was they settled the promised land. They had a king, and then the nation divided north and south, and they had two kings, and the northern kingdom falls victim to the expansionist aspirations of an empire, and it's destroyed, and the southern kingdom lasts a little bit longer, but then an even bigger empire comes in and destroys them, and their approach to colonizing the territory is to take the very brightest and best from this country and bring them off into Babylon, and to leave the poor and the poorly educated back home in the conquered territory, but the brightest and best are gone. After a period of time, that great empire is itself destroyed, and the new empire has a different approach to colonization. And that empire allows all those exiles to return back home. Now, of course, while they've been here, all sorts of new visions of what will happen when we get back there. It's going to be so great, and it's going to be beautiful, and God's going to make the way straight, and we're going to charge home. And they come back home, and after all the years away in exile, nothing has happened. The place is still as wrecked as it was when they left. What have you been doing here for these years? Well, do you know what? It's just as well we're back here, because we've got a vision for how this is going to work. And you see several streams fighting with one another within the biblical text for how to fix the country. I might, if I was coining a phrase, I might say, how to make Israel great again. So they stream back. There are people already there with a vision, and there are people coming back from outside with a vision. And in the Bible, these different streams are in, let's just say they're in dialogue with one another. So you have a character like Ezekiel and the followers of Ezekiel and a number of the other prophets in the Hebrew text. They're very, very clear. If we are going to restore the greatness of the nation, there's one thing to do. Put down all your hand tools. Stop building your homes, because the biggest problem in this country is the fact, the only way that we are going to restore the greatness of this nation is to restore spiritual purity again. Stop building your homes. Stop building the roads. Build the temple. Centralize worship in Jerusalem. That way God will return very quickly, and we'll restore all our great. The problem for us is we've wandered away from God. We will make Israel great again by rebuilding worship. Ezra and Nehemiah also come back, and they have a different vision for how to do it. And they say, well, one of the problems, one of the reasons why we have declined as a nation, one of the reasons why God has punished us is because we are not ethnically as pure as we were once upon a time. And if we're going to make the nation great again, we've got to restore our ethnic purity. And so together they pass a policy. They make a policy decision, and they force men who have married foreign wives, they force them to divorce those wives and send them away. And they marry good Jewish girls, and they have good Jewish kids. And through the process of ethnically purifying ourselves again, we can make the nation great again. And the violence displayed towards foreign women in the book of Ezra and Nehemiah is astounding. Talking about dragging them by the hair outside Jerusalem and throwing them away. Talking about beating men with sticks who are resisting the policy. Make Israel great again. The root is ethnic purity. So all of this ferment is going on about in post-exilic Judah, but making us great again, restoring our place on the world stage. And then this storyteller steps in and says, let me tell you a story. in the place of bread, there was a famine. And you think, ooh, that's a bit unusual. We don't expect that. So you're put on the back foot at the beginning of the story. And then this guy took his family, driven by famine, this guy took his family and they went across border into Moab. And everybody says, ha, we know what happens when you get there. Every time you turn to Moab for food and drink, food and water, what happens? They turn their back on you. Well, actually, Moab took this family in. Hold on a minute. These people can't be trusted. Well, here's a story about a family who found a welcome. Okay, well, that's... But you still can't trust their women. And the two boys found wives. Ah, yeah, yeah, but that didn't end well. Well, they found wives who stood with those men for 10 years, which is not a bad record. And then when those men died, those women stayed loyal to those men. In the tradition of the day, they would be entitled to ask Naomi for at least a proportion of the contract sum that their fathers would have paid to marry their daughters off to these boys. Because they died before they had children, they'd be entitled to say to Naomi, hand it back. And it appears in the story that they never requested this money back. Even Orpah, who eventually went back home, didn't ask for this sum because they knew Naomi was destitute and grieving the death of her father or her husband and her sons. Here's a story of Moabite women who stayed loyal to these men even after death. And the reader is put on the back foot and to say that here is just the possibility that not everybody in the state is Republican or Democrat. Not everybody in Minnesota wants to steal the clergy. Not every Mexican migrant worker wants to steal your jobs or your women or undermine the state. There is just the possibility that a different story might be told. Now, the writer's not saying anything. He's just saying it is a possibility. And then he says, just one more thing, we're kind of jumping to the end of the story. One more thing to you people who are fighting about ethnic purity. Can we jump ahead to the end of the story? Because there you have a genealogy. And he said, I'm telling you this story because I just want to remind you that your most revered leader had foreign blood. And there's a list of names at the very end of the book. And you find out that Ruth is the mother of an ancestor of King David. Even your best king had foreign blood. Can you really believe? Can you really hold that ethnic purity is... Because there is a different story. That seems to me to be one of the functions of this magnificent story of Ruth. To suggest through a story that different outcomes are possible. And so, just as we begin our wrap-up, here's your work for the next 24 hours, because we're going to pick it up here tomorrow, for those of you who choose to return. What is there in our faith life and practice which will assist us in telling a compelling counter-narrative to the story that the world is telling us about the borders and the foreignness that we have to negotiate? What is there in our liturgical practice? What is there in our founding stories? What is there in our faith practice that will assist us in our own particular contexts to play a role inspired by the storyteller of the Book of Ruth? What counter-narratives exist out there? What different stories can we tell about difference and diversity and the borders that we negotiate? I want to finish. I'm hoping this is going to work. Let me actually give you a bit of background to this. This is a poem about borders, and it'll maybe begin to open a little bit of the work that'll be done tonight with Padraig. This is a poem about the Canadian border. What was it they were described as?
Snow Mexicans.
Snow Mexicans. Someone described them, which I thought was just hilarious. And if we can't, and the poet is explaining the background to this poem, and it suggests a way in which borders can speak something beautiful to us.
Cross That Line is an important poem to me because I loved Paul Robeson so much as a child. I loved his voice. We had a record of him singing, and you know, I wouldn't read his biography till I was an adult and know about what he suffered as a so-called communist and how his passport was taken away from him and he was not allowed to leave the nation, though he had a huge fan club in Europe and elsewhere. So I thought this was so funny when he did this, and I now own a CD of this concert.
Really?
Yeah, someone sent it to me. I have some archival recording. Pretty amazing.
Wow.
Cross That Line. Paul Robeson stood on the northern border of the USA and sang into Canada, where a vast audience sat on folding chairs waiting to hear him. He sang into Canada. His voice left the USA when his body was not allowed to cross that line. Remind us again, brave friend. What countries may we sing into? What lines should we all be crossing? What songs travel toward us from far away to deepen our days?
Isn't that a fabulous, just a beautiful poem?
Only she had nine.
What does it suggest to you about the potential borders and belonging? What images, what phrases in that poem catch your imagination, hook themselves into you? Another powerful image of singing into Canada. But you'll notice the way, the movement, he sang into Canada, but the question she asks us is, what songs travel towards us? We assume we are here, but even as we stand and speak across that way, we will hear something coming back at us as we cross lines. Remind us again, brave friend. What countries may we sing into? What lines should we all be crossing? What songs travel towards us from far away? And then that beautiful promise at the end, to deepen our days. The possibility that as we encounter the differences, as we encounter the Moabites in our midst, a different narrative might be possible. And it presents the possibility that in that encounter, there will be something that will deepen our own life experience and our own understanding of the world, our own understanding of our faith through encounter with difference. I do wonder about that, and I do wonder in our context where it appears through media, as it does back home in relation to Brexit, that everybody has been pushed into one or other camp. And it takes great faith to believe that there may be actually a vast audience who are quiet, who have found their way to no camp, but who need some kind of rallying center. Some people who will dare to speak differently about the current divisions that are here, and the world, in many ways, needs America to find that vast audience in the middle, who will not be seduced by these other narratives of what to do with this division, and this isolation. Do we dare to believe that there's a vast audience if we speak into this place, if we sing into that space, that there will be a vast audience there to receive that song and change the way we think about the Moabites, allow the possibility that maybe what we have painted that whole people with, whether they are Democrats or Republicans, whether they are whoever they might be, we've painted them all in this way. Maybe there's sufficient diversity in them for common ground to be established. Yes.
It reminds me very much of the discussions that we went through, a few years ago, considering the gay lesbian situation, where once people got to know someone personally and realized they weren't evil, they were just like all of us, that we became more tolerant and opened our eyes, and I hope we can open up in a lot of ways by learning to know each other.
That is the Coromila strapline is transforming conflict through human encounter. Somebody has a vested interest in ensuring you don't encounter that person. And it takes courage, because that's often people with a degree of power, maybe even power to influence your life or my life in some way. And it takes immense courage to seek encounter when some have an interest in making sure that that doesn't happen. If the church can't be the people who do that, I don't know what we're here for. I really don't know what we're here for.
It strikes me that it takes courage on both sides. That besides, the whole cross that line talks about the voice going one way. There's a voice coming back.
Yeah, yeah. That's right. Yeah, yeah. This is a dialogue. This is an exchange. It is not, we have the answers here and here's how they're going to sort this out. It is that. Yeah.
Well, it's the very opposite of building walls. Whether you're talking about the walls of Palestinians and Israel, or you're talking about the walls that some people feel should be built in the U.S., there would be no wall where this can't do this if there's a wall.
Do you know what is true of both this poem and is also true of the storyteller in the Book of Ruth? It is the power of the human voice to make this, to defy even the walls. The Paul Robeson, the powers that be denied him his passport. He did not have a passport, therefore he couldn't travel. They shut him out, but they couldn't stop his voice traveling across that boundary. And likewise, I think with the story of Ruth, when we're keeping the stereotypes of this people group intact, but the freedom that the writer has allows a voice to cross over what otherwise appeared to be an impenetrable border, wall. There is power in a human voice to defy those walls. Yes, sir.
Well, silencing is such an obvious technique, but there's also silencing the ear of the listener. And I remember from my childhood, it was illegal to have a radio. My parents had their radio in mom's sewing machine. And they worried about my talking about that.
Yeah.
Because they would have been killed for it. So it is both of the listener and the speaker.
Yeah. That's an incredible story. Incredible story.
So it makes me think that, there's the hope for our future, that we're going to find the songs that we can sing together.
Yeah.
It won't just be singing across corners, but that we join together in song.
I think what, in part motivates us in this work is actually the power of art. The clashing political voices of post-exilic Judah and the inflated egos and the power games that were being played were punctured by a story about a refugee woman. I mean, it is an extraordinary thing to imagine that we say it almost pejoratively, a simple story is enough to undermine these loud, clashing, powerful voices up here. Do we believe that a song can do this? Do we believe that a story or a poem can do this? Do we believe that our liturgy can do this? So if so, what does it look like? And how do we do it? And how do we build our skills? How do we improve our listening? And where do we find the courage to speak a story as this writer did about this woman? Goodness, you've been here a long time. This is an incredible book, and I think with incredible contemporary resonances. And we'll continue to explore it over the next couple of days, and we'll explore it in a different way in the evening sessions with Padraig. Do you want to say anything about this evening?
So this evening we'll be taking the idea of abandonment and really looking at the story of Naomi and Ruth and exploring their idea and their experience of abandonment, looking at some poetry about abandonment, and consider how is it that the artistic project of poetry can find us in a new way present to the stories of abandonment. And tomorrow we'll be looking at poetry of resolve, because certainly Ruth and later Naomi and also Boaz to a lesser extent experience resolve. And then on Thursday we'll be looking at poetry of community, because the whole story of the Book of Ruth evolves really into a story of community and kindness.
Great.
So, and you'll be writing, but you don't have to feel like you're a poet. I'll manipulate and trick you into writing poetry. don't in any way worry that you are or are not a writer. All you need is paper and ears and the ability to write in a way that you can read. So that's all we need.
Brilliant.
It'll be lovely. We'll spend a lot of time talking with each other.
Thank you, everybody. Thank you.